and Americans for the Arts.
Morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up, we're going to talk about immigration. Of course, it's been in the news for months and months. We're going to talk with a leading local expert on immigration. Why do people come from places like Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador to the U.S.? We'll talk about that in just a moment with a live guest. But first, two listener comments about the last few shows. And one of the comments was about last Friday's interview with Greg Pallas, the investigative reporter, who was telling us that we shouldn't believe all we hear and see about Venezuela. He says the story is much deeper. And here's what two listeners have said following the last few shows.
Yeah, hello. I've been listening to the program this morning and disagree a lot with that investigative reporter. He talks about how well the socialists did down there in improving the country and everything and what's going on now with American interference. And there is American interference, but he fails to mention the fact that there are actually death squads going around and killing people, taking them off the streets and killing them, murdering them. And I haven't heard him say anything about that yet, and that bothers the hell out of me. I've got friends that came up from Venezuela, and they told me there's so much killing, back alley killing from government troops and these death squads, it's incredible. And if he's an investigative reporter, that's one of the things he should have mentioned. But for some strange reason, he's not bringing that up.
This is Fred in St. Pete. I enjoyed your show today, as I do every day. It's Monday. I was listening to Jane Castor talk about what she would do if a Category 5 hurricane headed for the Tampa Bay area. Being a resident of St. Pete, my ears perked up when she mentioned one of the first priorities would be to let the citizens of St. Pete come through first. And I'm curious as to how in the world that would ever work, because all the people in Tampa and Hillsborough, they want to get out too. How would you organize an evacuation where St. Pete people could get out of St. Pete and go through Tampa?
Well, that was a listener comment, or two of them, that came in after last Friday's show and Monday's replay of the Tampa mayoral debate. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. President Trump says there's only one person in charge of his immigration policy, him. Trump was asked today as he was leaving the White House this morning whether he had ever considered tapping his influential aide Stephen Miller to lead the department. In the wake of Kirstjen Nielsen's departure, Trump says Miller is an excellent guy and a brilliant man, but said, frankly, there's only one person that's running it. You know who that is. It's me. And so President Trump saying that he's definitely in charge of immigration policy. Meantime, the Army Corps of Engineers has awarded contracts totaling nearly $1 billion for removal and replacement of vehicle fencing with pedestrian fencing along two sections of the U.S.-Mexico border. The giant contracts go to companies in Texas and Montana. Meantime, under pressure to show that they have solutions, Democrats are honing proposals to address the surge of families entering the U.S. at the southern border, a problem that they say President Trump's restrictive immigration policies are inflaming. House Democrats plan to introduce legislation soon addressing the recent waves of Central American migrants reaching the border. Senate Democrats are pursuing multiple tracks, including exploring whether talks with the White House might be feasible. The bill, which participants said is still being finalized, is expected to increase federal resources at border entry points for processing refugees, counseling children, and treating people needing medical care. It would create centers in Central American countries where asylum applications could be processed and provide aid to reduce poverty and violence in the Central American region so fewer people would flee their countries. Zoe Lofgren, a California congressman and a Democrat, said you don't just wait for people to show up at the border. It's the worst way to deal with it. She's working with Jerry Nadler and other party leaders on this legislation. The measure represents Democrats' efforts to find the sweet spot between addressing a burgeoning humanitarian crisis and not lending credibility to Trump's assertion that hordes of immigrants are invading the country. They say Trump has exacerbated the situation by aggressively detaining migrants caught entering the U.S. illegally and slowing the process of asylum seekers, which can take months or longer. Congressman Ruben Gallego of Arizona said this is a manufactured crisis. Gallego is a Democrat. Trump says the U.S. faces a security and humanitarian calamity. In a letter to lawmakers last month, Kirstjen Nielsen, who heads Immigration Department asked for immediate congressional assistance to address a system-wide meltdown. She requested funds for more detention beds, medical teams, and processing facilities, but specified no dollar amounts. Democrats have been skeptical of such requests. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal from Washington State said that they've already taken and transferred money from things to their ridiculous wall, referring to Trump's effort to build a border wall that Democrats have mocked as ineffective. She said, it's pretty difficult for me to say I'd give them more. I'd have to have a lot more accountability built in, and I'd cut the amount we're giving to Homeland Security until they can show us they really need it. Democrats contend that Trump's goal is to rile up his conservative voters as the 2020 election nears. That Republicans say Democrats are simply out to block Trump. We're going to talk about immigration right now with Harry Vanden, who's a professor emeritus at USF in Tampa. He's a former Fulbright scholar. He's the founding director of the Latin American Studies Department at USF, and he has traveled extensively in Latin America. He's lived there for a time. He's a fluent Spanish speaker and a longtime friend of MNF. And Harry Vanden, welcome back to the airwaves.
Thank you, Robin. It's great to be here, particularly with you here.
Okay. Well, thank you for saying that. It's good to be back. First of all, how bad would you say the problems are in places like Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador? Why are people leaving those countries?
Yeah, unfortunately, the problems are really severe there and have been for some time. I was in Honduras in January, and in Nicaragua in February, but Honduras is rather sad, frankly. The per capita income is in the vicinity of $4,000 a year, but of course there's a horrible disparity in income. So you find that the minimum wage is sometimes less than $200 a month. People are just scraping by. But what's particularly sad and where I'm spending a lot of my time recently is the violence and particularly the gangs that exist in so many of the neighborhoods and even small towns and cities in Honduras, as is also the case in El Salvador and Guatemala, where you have these gangs, particularly MS-13 or M-18, that take over a neighborhood and just almost become the real government there, the de facto government of them, and just extort people, abuse people, pick out young women and say, you're going to be my girlfriend, and just not let it go, rape them, gang rape them, even kill them if they don't comply, try to recruit the young men to the gangs and again become very insistent and are ready to abuse them badly physically and indeed kill them as well. So these conditions are what really terrify people. One could make the argument that indeed these gangs and other criminal organizations, because there are cartels in Central America now, that they really terrorize whole sections of the population, and I think that would be very very accurate. So people are terrorized, people are fleeing for their lives, and I think we have a moral, an ethical obligation, but we're also bound to accept refugees who have legitimate needs for refuge per our signing of the 1951 Refugee Treaty. Indeed, interestingly enough, the United States was one of the proponents and facilitators of that treaty, which gives those who are suffering political, racial, religious, or other forms of discrimination or of targeting the right to seek refuge in our country or other countries.
Well, we have a history of allowing refugees in from other countries, and I'm thinking of the closest to home example of that is Cuba, where probably a million or more people left Cuba after the revolution to come here, and we gave them tremendous financial assistance because they said that they were fleeing a repressive government, so we helped them out with our tax dollars.
Yes, we have. It's changed now a bit, but that went on, of course, for 50 years or so after the revolution. But indeed, this country was developed by allowing refugees in, including mine and your forefathers and foremothers. And I think that's terribly important to remember. We had some lapses around the Second World War. My ex-wife's family was not allowed to come into the United States in 1939 because they were Jews fleeing the Holocaust. Fortunately, it was Cuba that took them, and they lived in Cuba for 2 years. So that's one of our sad periods. And a lot of people make that comparison now because obviously they were in very real danger for political, ethnic, and religious reasons, just as many of the Central American refugees are. So many people look at that and say, well, you know, we sort of blew it then. Let's not blow it again. But it would seem that we are not living up to our history of being a country of immigrants or of welcoming the huddled masses to our shores.
Well, we're talking about why people from Central America are fleeing their countries with Professor Harry Vanden from USF, and our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address, dj@wmnf.org. These gangs, MS-13 and MS-18, that you talked about, especially in Honduras, do they make their money from selling drugs? Is that where they're getting their money from?
No, they sell drugs in the neighborhood, but sort of on a small scale. The sad, one of the sad parts, though, selling drugs is also sad. And there are cartels that are promoting the large-scale transfer and sale of drugs. But they mostly extort people. You live in a neighborhood, they say, well, you live here and we're going to impose a war tax. That is to say, since we're the government or we're the people in charge, you're going to pay us $20 a week, $30 a week. And they up it after time. If you have a small business, then they would ask for maybe $50 a week. If you run a taxi cab, they'd ask for $20 or $30 a week. In talking to some of the folks in Central America, even if you're the Coca-Cola company that has to make delivery in that neighborhood, you have to pay them, you know, $30 or $40, maybe more, just to be able to come to that neighborhood and work through that neighborhood. So extortion is one of their primary means, if not their primary means of financing themselves, and they get very vicious if one does not comply with their extortion demands.
Can you trace MS-13 and MS-18 back to the U.S.? I mean, are these people whose families were deported and they learned gang culture in the U.S.? Is that at all true?
Yeah, very true. It's sad and ironic, but with the political conflicts that went on in Central America in the 1980s, more and more people had to seek refuge in the U.S., and to our credit, we did let many of them in. But of course, we didn't really give the assistance that, say, we did to the Cuban refugees, and they ended up living in poor neighborhoods, specifically places like South Central in Los Angeles, that is to say, in poor neighborhoods. And as the kids got there or were born and grew up, they soon found that they had to contend with the gang culture. And the existent gangs, Latin and others, started to pick on them, single them out, and they felt they had to do something. So in the case of MS-13, which means Mara Salvatrucha, or the Salvadoran wise guys, they formed their own gang. And that's how it started. And that was in the 1980s. Of course, it still exists in those neighborhoods. M18 was a Mexican gang that the Salvadoran, Honduran, Guatemalan refugees took over. Indeed, it means 18th Street Gang. So their roots are directly in the U.S., and as with so many things that are going on now, directly tied to U.S. policy. The U.S. Would not allow the Salvadorans to make a full blown revolution, a thoroughgoing revolution. We spent $5 billion stopping that in the 1980s and managed to get 70,000 or so Salvadorans killed. We did the same thing in Guatemala from really 1954 on, stopping, or indeed in 54, overthrowing a legitimate revolution, and then supporting rather brutal, indeed, racially intolerant, that is to say, genocidal military regimes in Guatemala. And there was a civil war that went on there and didn't end until the mid-1990s. In Honduras, there was not a civil war, but we supported the most conservative people and used Honduras as a base to support and supply the Contras in Nicaragua. So in the case of those three countries then, there was intense and extreme and ongoing U.S. intervention in their normal political processes, such that the reforms or the thoroughgoing revolutions that were and are so badly needed were stopped. Thinking of Honduras, it's very symbolic that you had in the late part of the first decade of the 21st century, that is to say, 2009, you had a very progressive president in power, that is to say.
This was during the Obama administration.
Yeah.
And Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, was that right?
That's right. And so
he was overthrown.
He was overthrown. And why was he overthrown? Well, he wanted to do things like double the minimum wage. He wanted to make some structural reforms. He did want to make some changes in the Constitution. But his name, of course, was Manuel Zelaya. And the U.S., although I don't think it would be fair to say orchestrated, it certainly supported that coup to overthrow him. So he was thrown out of the country. And with him, the very real necessary and legitimate attempts to reform and change Honduras. One wonders how many fewer Honduran refugees would have come to the U.S. and continue to come to the U.S. if the minimum wage had been doubled. And indeed, if that were doubled, then one wonders how many kids would get the support and parental guidance that they needed to not become gang members, because so many of their parents had to leave because they were threatened or because they had to seek a better livelihood outside the U.S.
There's several countries where refugees don't tend to come from in Central America. One of those countries is Costa Rica. Why don't people leave Costa Rica to come to the U.S.?
Yeah, very good question. Well, the reality is those countries in Central America that have made the profound and necessary changes, or at least started to or tried to, are those that have the fewest refugees coming to the U.S., and Costa Rica is an excellent example, because in the late 40s and early 50s, there was a revolution in Costa Rica, a thoroughgoing revolution, where they sort of got rid of the old landowners, the old way of doing things, and installed a very democratic and progressive government that went on to make Costa Rica one of those countries that has the highest literacy rates, that has the best health care, that pays their workers sometimes as twice as much as other Central American countries. So this delightful little Switzerland of Central America has done very well. And because the revolution was not communist, was not leftist, the U.S. did not try to overthrow it or undermine it as it did with the Nicaraguan revolution, or the attempts to make a revolution in El Salvador or Guatemala. So the U.S. allowed this revolution, this change, to flourish, and indeed it did flourish. They actually abolished their military and decided to spend their money on schools and hospitals and infrastructure, et cetera, which they did. So it's very interesting. Indeed, sometimes you see a migration of people to Costa Rica from other Central American countries because things are so much better there.
Well, we're discussing why people flee some Central American countries and try to come to places like Texas and Arizona and New Mexico and California. Our guest is Dr. Harry Van Landon, Professor Emeritus at USF in Tampa. He was the founding director of the Latin American Studies Department there. He's traveled widely in South and Central America and lived for a time. Did you live for a time in Peru? Is that?
I did. I lived for 2 years in Peru, 6 months in Brazil, months at a time in Venezuela, and weeks at a time in several Central American countries.
We're going to take some phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. You mentioned Venezuela. The U.S. government, the Trump administration, is calling for regime change in Venezuela. I have not heard them call for regime change in Honduras, Guatemala, or El Salvador. And I wonder what you make of that. And I was reading a story last week that said that there are 3 million refugees who have left Venezuela.
Yes. Well, obviously things are not good in Venezuela. It remains to be seen whether the U.S. trying to change the regime is the best way to deal with that. But certainly the U.S. has been reticent, indeed unwilling, to even sanction the post-coup government in Honduras, and certainly hadn't talk for regime change, etc. And most recently, the now president, or continuing president of Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez, had an election just last year that was very questionable. And indeed, he manipulated the Supreme Court and the Constitution to allow himself to run for a second time. But the U.S. accepted that, and accepted him in power and has worked with him. And their solution to the problems has been almost exclusively military, with very little aid and support for the type of economic, social, structural changes that are so badly needed and would indeed be a very effective way, if they were done, to stem this influx of refugees from Honduras and other Central American countries.
Let's take some phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. We're talking about refugees from Central America coming to the U.S., the source of a lot of discussion in Washington, D.C. Let's go to Frederico in Clearwater Beach. Frederico, you're on. What's your question for Dr. Vanden?
Yes, thank you for taking me. I want to make everybody aware that whatever this gentleman is saying is not based on reality. It's completely the opposite. In fact, Manuel Zelaya was trying to establish a communist dictatorship, suspend the constitution, and his biggest alliance was with Chavez, which is the worst enemy of the United States and of democracy that we have ever seen in Latin America. Also, when we took down Jacobo Arbenz in the 50s, it was because he was signing up with the Russians. It was a Cold War, and we had to do it. There's nothing, you know, that we couldn't have done. We had to take him down because he was siding with the Russians, and we're going to have a military base or a threat very close to our shores, and we cannot allow that. Also, Venezuela is a communist regime that overthrew the constitution. Every time there is an election, they put all the opposition, the leaders in jail. They illegalize the parties. They just don't want to lose an election, and people don't vote because they don't have any means to secure the result. We, the opposition in Venezuela, I count myself amongst them, are 85% of the people, and we have no voice in government. This gentleman is only siding with the left, and the left is the enemy of the people. 10% a year inflation in Venezuela because of socialist policies. I mean, printing money without anything to buy with, which is exactly what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is trying to do in the United States, printing money.
All right. And Frederico, thanks a lot. And Frederico, could I ask you a quick question? When did you leave Venezuela?
25 years ago.
25 years ago. All right. Frederico, thank you.
Yeah, 25.
All right, 25. Thank you. Thank you for your comments. All right, Harry, what would you say back to Frederico?
Yeah, I would say Frederico is symbolic of so many people in Latin America who don't want to make any change at all. It's rather sad that his information is 25 years old. I've been in Venezuela more frequently than that, but we're really not talking about Venezuela today. Conditions are bad in Venezuela, without any question. But factually, he's totally mistaken in calling it a communist government. It is a socialist government. government, to be sure, but it's more of an authoritarian government than anything else. But let's be clear, the government in Guatemala that was overthrown by the CIA in 1954 was a democratically elected government. It was the fruit of an attempt at structural change in Guatemala, and was not indeed a communist government. There were a few communists in the government, but the main perpetrator of the coup, of course, was the U.S. and particularly the United Fruit Company, because they lost land.
The United Fruit Company lost land. Arbenz was democratically elected.
He was.
And he was overthrown with the help of United Fruit, which is one of the big fruit companies operating here in the U.S. with reach all the way to Central and South America.
Yes, that's correct. And also it functions in Honduras and a bit in El Salvador, though it's bigger in Honduras.
But Frederico, he claims all these people are hardcore communists that we've overthrown, justifying that. When we look at Honduras, for instance, just a few years ago in 2009, Zelaya, was he going to turn it into a hardcore communist country?
Yeah, that's really interesting. Manuel Zelaya was actually a landowner. He was part of the sort of elite, indeed the conservative elite. He was, active in one of the major, not the Communist Party, not even a leftist party, but one of the main parties in Honduras. And his wife has tried to get elected twice since then, first as president and then as vice president, because they won't let him run. So unfortunately, this view that anyone who wants to make change, who wants to make reform, is a communist, is outdated and frankly incorrect. But it's interesting that Federico said this, because it's symbolic of this sort of very narrow, skewed view that so many people in the United States have had, a few still have, which has really warped our policy and made us unable to see legitimate reformers as people who are true nationalists and who will make the changes that will improve the conditions in a country. By allowing conditions to continue to be horrendous in so much of Central America, these become then the breeding grounds, not just for gangs or for cartels, but for corruption. And several of the Central American presidents have been accused and indeed even indicted for corruption. And they don't allow the natural rhythm of change, reform, that's so badly needed in Central America. And I'm glad that most people are moving away from that very arcane and biased and clouded policy that has stopped the U.S. from allowing so much change that is so badly needed. Jimmy Carter, of course, was to a degree an exception to that.
We're going to take some more phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. We're talking about, why do people leave their Central American nations to come to the U.S.? What are they fleeing? The Democrats, Harry, say that what they want to do is they want to let people apply for political asylum within places like Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, and they want to set up a new Marshall Plan in those countries. What guarantee, if they were to find some money for that, and I don't think in this Congress they're likely to find that money, but what guarantee is there that the money won't be ripped off and used by the elites if the money goes down to Central America?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, so much of that money has been siphoned off by the elites and by the existent groups, but that's a plan that's worthy of some consideration. The only problem is that while the folks have applied there, and that would beat, you know, having to jump a border fence, I suppose. Why do I say I suppose? Because, as I stated initially, so many people are literally fleeing for their lives. So you live in a neighborhood, you're being extorted, you don't have the money to pay the extortion. The gang has said, you know, if you don't pay us $50 or $100, and sometimes they ask for even more, you know, in a week or 2 weeks, there'll be consequences. Indeed, by the way, you know, we know where your daughter goes to school, we know what bus she takes, and I'm sure you want to take care of her. That is to say, they're saying that if you don't pay us and pay us in a short period, we'll take your daughter away, we'll make her a gang girlfriend, or perhaps we'll just kill her outright. So if folks you know, are waiting around for a visa. The question would be, how are they going to survive in the meantime? And that's the problem. So that might be a good idea, but you still need the socioeconomic structural changes that allow people to live there and that can protect them from the violence of the gangs and the cartels and other criminal organizations.
All these countries have militaries. Do the militaries in Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, do they have any interaction with the gangs? And if so, what's that interaction or interaction with the cartels as well?
Well, probably more the cartels than the gangs. What's sad is the military have been brought in to sort of support the police in suppressing the gangs or trying to eliminate them. And indeed, some of them are corrupt. But in this regard, they are probably not corrupt and suborned like the local police are. What's really sad is that in Honduras, in Guatemala, and likewise even in El Salvador, so many of the police are on the take and work with the gangs. Some of them are even gang members. I've had several individuals who are applying for asylum tell me that some of the police in El Salvador have MS-13 tattooed on the inside of their lower lip so they can curl their lip down and show it to people to further intimidate them or to enforce what the gang asks for. So the corruption and the ineffectiveness of the police is very bad. And yes, they are some, not all. There's some very brave and honest policemen and police women who risk their lives to try to control the gangs. And indeed, for instance, in 2017, the gangs killed 39 policemen and women, and also killed some of their family members. In that the military did work with the police, to answer your question a little more directly, in that the military did work with the police in El Salvador. They also killed a few military individuals, military personnel who were working with the police, and even threatened and killed a couple family members of military men. They were all male in this case, who worked with the police to suppress the gangs.
Our guest is Harry Vanden, Professor Emeritus at USF in Tampa. He's an expert on Central America and South America. In fact, oftentimes he is asked to be an expert witness in refugee cases. And this is 88.5 FM. If you got a question for Dr. Vanden, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. And let's go back to the phones for a second. We're going to go to Nancy in St. Petersburg. Nancy, you're on with Professor Vanden.
Hello.
Hi, Nancy, you're on.
Yes, hi. Professor Banton, is it?
Yes.
Hi. Oh,
hi.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, listen, this is such a thing near and dear to my heart that you're talking about, because I remember Fidel Castro on the cover of Life magazine way back in the midst of time as being a hero to the United States. And all of a sudden he wasn't. And so much has happened, with our foreign policy for Latin America, that has just gone down the tube since then. And I think that is part of the game plan of the folks who are in charge of Guatemala, Honduras, especially El Salvador, that all of this stuff with the police and the military, It just keeps everything in chaos, and nothing ever happens. The squeeze is on, and it just drives me crazy.
Okay, Nancy, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Harry, I want to ask you about Nicaragua. Federico took you to task for being on the left, but mm-hmm. You are critical of Nicaragua these days. And until recently, as I've been reading about the refugees coming from Central America, I almost never see a Nicaraguan quoted as being there on the California border or Texas border. Mostly it's people from Salvador and other countries. Now I'm beginning to see quotes from people from Nicaragua, leaving Nicaragua. Just give us a brief synopsis of why people are leaving Nicaragua, which did not have many refugees if you go back 2 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, well, the Sandinistas took over on July 19th, 1979, and they started to make fundamental changes and did make many fundamental changes, particularly in education and healthcare and things like that. And conditions were starting to get better. Of course, the U.S. then set up, organized, and financed the Contra War, which cost the lives of some 30,000 Nicaraguans and sort of stymied the revolutionary input and the changes that were necessary. Because of that, and a few mistakes the Sandinistas made, the Sandinistas were voted out of power in 1990, and a very friendly regime to the U.S. took over, and the Sandinistas did not get back in power until 2006, and it was Daniel Ortega who was then elected. He had been the president the Sandinista president in the 1980s as well. And because of this, then, even though, interestingly enough, Nicaragua is very poor, indeed probably the second or third poorest country in the hemisphere after Haiti and perhaps Bolivia, but even though the economic conditions were not great, there were sufficient reforms, and there was a fairly effective government under the Sandinistas that was at least meeting the needs or trying to meet the needs of the majority of the population and received a lot of support and indeed some enthusiasm for that. Unfortunately, though, for a variety of reasons, Daniel Ortega sort of allowed his authoritarian tendencies to develop. Indeed, my co-author and I have done a couple books and many articles and book chapters on Nicaragua. My co-author and I were criticized for being critical of Ortega earlier on because he started to show his authoritarian streaks within his own party after he lost the 1990 elections and after he left the presidency. But after 2006, he returned to the government. He did get some support from Venezuela, and the oil definitely helped the Nicaraguans. But as he stayed in power, he used his power to basically pack the Supreme Court, to get more of his people in Congress, to make changes that allowed him to increase his power and increase his span of control over the government. And this, of course, led to accusations of election tampering, if not election fraud. And those, of course, as you had several elections since 2006, those criticisms have become even more strident and with some basis. Now, what happened then starting in April of 2018 was that firstly, the government, and in this last election, I should note, Daniel Ortega, put his wife up as vice president and had her elected as vice president, Murillo. Very questionable move, but symbolic of the way he was taking more and more power and becoming more and more arbitrary as government. So people were not thrilled with that, although many people did still support the Sandinistas because, I repeat, they made some of the socioeconomic changes that the masses so badly needed, though clearly not a sufficient amount or a sufficient number. But in 2018, there was a forest fire in a national reserve, and the Sandinista government kind of blew it. They even turned down offers from Costa Rica to send firefighters, etc. So a lot of that national forest got burned, perhaps unnecessarily. There were a few demonstrations and some unhappiness with that, particularly by students. But what really sparked the change in events in Nicaragua was the fact that Daniel Ortega and company had not been able to run the government too well, and their revenue was insufficient to support the social security system. The social security system is not only the pension system in Nicaragua, it is the health care system as well. And so they were looking at a very severe shortfall in the funds needed to continue the existing social security system. What did they do? Well, they decided to make changes. Firstly, they introduced legislation to increase the number of years that one had to work in order to be a pensioner. Secondly, they said that those who wanted to be part of the Social Security system would have to increase their contribution. That is to say, they would have to pay more. And thirdly, they said that they would reduce the pension once people were able to get it. And this was just way too much for the people. And so in April and May of 2018, thousands of people took to the streets and protested this, mostly youth, mostly students, particularly from the two large universities, the National University and the Central American University. And this shocked, surprised the government. The government thought that they might be pushed from power, and so they mobilized the police. And very soon then, they started to come down on the demonstrators, protesters, very strongly. That is to say, they started to shoot at them. So in these months after April, for the rest of the year, as people tried to demonstrate, they were shot. There were some 320 people killed, mostly by the police and security forces, and also para-police, paramilitaries, and also by some of the Sandinista gangs that were employed.
And if you were to compare, I mean, that's a horrible situation, but if you were to compare the number of people that have been killed in Guatemala since 1954 or the number of people killed in El Salvador in the last 30 years, how would those numbers in Nicaragua compare?
Well, they would be less. I mean, the sad part about what had transpired in Guatemala was that as people tried to resist the authoritarian military governments that the U.S. supported, with the exception of Carter, in Guatemala, from 54 to, let's say, 2015 or thereabouts, there were 200,000 Guatemalans that were killed.
Huge number.
And further, even worse, in Guatemala, the military regimes went after the indigenous people. So there were very legitimate claims that the military government, usually with U.S. support, was engaging in genocide.
And Salvador?
And at Salvador, the revolution there cost approximately 70,000 lives, just a revolution.
Let's take a call from Sarita in St. Petersburg. Sarita, you're on with Professor Harry Vanden. What's your question?
Hi. Yes, it's not a question, and my name is Sarita.
I'm sorry, Sarita.
Thank you. Actually, I am also from Venezuela, and I wanted to apologize to the professor for that other gentleman from Venezuela who called in and very rudely tried to discredit his argument. I agree with the professor. I think he's right in his statements about Venezuela, and I know the problem is not about Venezuela, but people don't like to hear this. In Venezuela, there used to be a second class that used to have a living maid, and they lost that, and of course, they're upset about it. And Venezuela is not good now. It hasn't been good since a long time. I was born in the 80s. And I left Venezuela about 10 years ago. My family left Venezuela, most of them, about 2 years ago. And they didn't come to the United States. They went to Europe. But I do agree with the professor. And I also have friends from El Salvador that describe exactly what the professor has described as far as the police officers, the own government picking on the people. So I do agree with the professor, and I wanted to apologize to him. Not every Venezuelan feels the same way as that rude person who called in earlier.
All right. Sarita, thank you so much.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. One finds is the diversity of opinion, and it's wonderful to hear another opinion from someone in Venezuela. As I said, I've not only been to Venezuela many times. In fact, I worked with Jimmy Carter and the Carter Center to be an international election monitor for the 1998 election that elected Hugo Chavez. And indeed, one finds then and now that there is a variety of opinion in Venezuela, so I think it's absolutely wonderful to hear that. No apology necessary. I'm full well aware of how it is. One of the things that really caught my attention when I was in Venezuela, and this sort of comes back to haunt us, doesn't it, was that I was monitoring the election. I was up in Mérida, and I talked to this party organizer prior to the election, and he sort of whispers in my ear, "Well, if Chavez wins, won't the U.S. send in the Marines?" And that was sort of symbolic. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. That is a big threat that I remember even when I was growing up in the 80s. People will say, USA will send the Marines, the USA will send the Marines. And it's just like you said, it's a whispered tribal threat that people have in their minds.
All right, Sarita, thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you for allowing me to speak up.
That's good.
Have a great day.
All right, you too. Let's go to John in Tampa. John, do you have a question or a statement for Professor Harry Vanden?
Yeah, why do people fight back over there? I don't understand why people would take these gangs so seriously. Like, they infested Brentwood in Long Island, Senator Richards, Shirley, all those little towns in Long Island. The people are scared of them. And I can't see why you have to be so scared of little hoodlums when you can take them out before they take you out. Don't get it.
All right, John, thanks a lot. That's a good question. So fighting back, is it possible in Honduras to fight back?
Yeah, it's really interesting. As you indicated, I've done a great many refugee cases in U.S. immigration courts, actually about 200 at this point. And I was able to interview a few people who did exactly what John suggested, that is to say, to fight back. And they would form a neighborhood organization, try to fight back, and the gangs would just kill them. One of the cases I did, the gang just killed the whole group of them and tossed them in a landfill. And the guy was fortunately still alive, though wounded, and survived. And that's when he left. So, yeah, I mean, not only do individuals sometimes try, though you must realize that the gangs are effective. Indeed, they really do wield the arm of terror, and they just go after anyone who even starts to disagree with them. And, yeah, they're little hoodlums, but they're nasty, violent little hoodlums. And, of course, some of them now are in their early 20s as they've matured a bit. But these boys and girls, and there are some girls, too, some women, they're well-armed. So, minimally, they have, they have 9mm automatics, but they also have access to assault rifles like an M16, left over from the Civil War, or an AK-47, easy to buy. And if they don't have that, they use a machete. So they just viciously go after anyone who even refuses to pay, etc. One of the sad things, or it's interesting but sad, is that evangelicals who preach in their neighborhoods against the gang way of life are targeted by the gangs. And I've had the opportunity to interview probably close to a dozen people who have been targeted by the gangs in El Salvador, Honduras, and a little bit in Guatemala, just because they belong to an evangelical church and had youth groups that were trying to dissuade people from joining the gangs or get the people to leave the gangs. And they go after them viciously. One young woman, they threatened her, they took her, they gang raped her. For the men, they threatened them. They've killed loose leaders. They've killed a few ministers, etc. So, and the problem is, and this really gets at your question too, which is a good one, is okay. These little so and so's are messing with me. They're coming after me. I want to come after them. I'm going to go to the police. Well, they go to the police, and firstly, the police are not real enthusiastic about coming to the neighborhood because they could get shot, as they did. Secondly, they may not really want to take an official complaint because it makes them look worse than they already are. And thirdly, some of them and people who work in the police stations are in cahoots with the gangs, so they're telling them that the guy came, and then they'll target the gang and go. They'll target this individual who was trying to stand up against the gangs. They'll target him and his friends because he went to the police, and they know he went to the police, and they say, you can't do that, and we're going to kill you.
We're talking about why people flee Central America, especially the countries of El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, with Professor Harry Vanden of USF. And if you've got a question, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. Harry, your latest book, what's the name of your latest book?
Well, the most recent one to come out is Politics of Latin America, The Power Game. It's a textbook on Latin American politics published by Oxford University Press. And it's on my mind because our editor is just prodding my co-author and I to do a seventh edition. It's in its sixth edition now and is, I'm told, the most widely used textbook on Latin American politics.
Sometimes you hear the president and his allies here in the U.S. say that people are coming here because they want free stuff, and that somehow, now when Cubans came here from Cuba fleeing Fidel Castro, there was a Cuban Adjustment Act, and they would get a lot of free stuff, no doubt about it. Now, it's not a lock sure. If you have a private refugee agency, you might get some help from a private refugee agency, but our government doesn't give that much help. But when the president says people want free stuff, that's why they're coming here, what would you say back to President Trump if he were here with us?
That's just not the case. From everything I've been able to find out from talking to people, from doing these cases, from reading and talking to other authorities, I think what people want is the ability to gain a living and maintain their families. We're saying that the minimum wage in Central America is $200 in all three countries. We're talking about the northern tier is $200 or maybe a little bit more per month, and most people don't even get that. So they can come here, they can work in construction or in landscaping or in lawn care in Florida, and they can make more than that in a week, maybe much more. So, folks, they don't want anything free, though I suppose they would like that, but that's not why they come. They come to get away from violence, to live, and if they work, they just want the opportunity to work, et cetera, which is, of course, one of the problems, because if you do come here, you work hard, you even pay Social Security, you may well use someone else's Social Security number, et cetera, but, you have to get back and forth to work, and so you pay your money, you buy a vehicle, you have insurance on it, you're a good member of the community and go to church and support community activities, invest in your children in many ways, and you get stopped because you have a broken taillight and they find out that you don't have a driver's license. This, in turn, then can trigger ICE, et cetera, and you can be deported back to the country. So just being able to come here and work and maintain themselves and their families is what the Central American refugees want. I think that folks in Florida in particular have learned just how hardworking so many migrants from Central America or Mexico are in the construction industry, in lawn care, and in many other areas.
And if every country in Central America had the peaceful calm of Costa Rica, people would be staying. They wouldn't be leaving, right?
Of course they would. People, don't want to risk their lives. They don't want to risk their children's lives. They don't want to leave their homes, their communities, their families. They only do so if they're up against it and really see no other alternatives. And oftentimes they stay. Of course, some of them stay too long and they're killed by the gangs or the cartels, or their kids are recruited into the gangs or criminal organizations. So no, people don't leave easily. They'd like to stay there. And I think it would be in the benefit of the United States and indeed all of us to give the support to enable them to do so. And that would involve not only support for the police, the military, which we've done, though perhaps not enough, let's say, but to change socioeconomic conditions. One of the real sad things about the gangs in Central America is that most of these kids have no alternatives. There are no jobs for them. So the only way they can get by or get any money is to join the gangs and then, of course, exploit people and abuse people.
Sometimes I look at my clothing and I notice it's made in Guatemala or El Salvador, and I wonder, what are the working conditions for those people in Central America?
Well, they're the lucky ones because they at least have a job. But again, what's the minimum wage? Minimum wage, $180, $200, so maybe they make a couple hundred bucks a month. Maybe in some plants they can make a little bit more. Not really enough to live. That would not sustain a family very well or very long. A second person would have to work, or the kids would have to work at an early age.
Let's go to Sister Kelly, who's calling in. Sister Kelly, we just have about 25 seconds. What would you like to ask Harry?
Yes, real quickly. Hopefully the next time Professor comes on, if he can discuss Colombia versus the archipelago of San Andres Island and Providence. I would appreciate that. It's very necessary. Thank you so much.
Harry Vanda, do you know about the islands in Colombia?
No, I know a bit about the coast. I've been in Colombia on the coast, etc. That would be a whole different discussion. But certainly, there are many. My daughter-in-law is Colombian, so that gives us a nice family connection. But there are many problems in Colombia that also need to be remedied as well. And the violence there from the long-term civil war was horrendous, and some of it's still going on.
Do you have a website?
No.
You don't? Okay.
But I have a web address, and I'd be happy to take requests.
All right. If people want to send you an email, what's your address on the web?
It's Vanden, V as in Victor, A-N-D-E-N, at usf.edu.
Oh, well, that's pretty easy. Vanden at usf.edu. Harry Vanden, thanks a lot for coming by.
My pleasure, Rob.
Good to see you again. Harry is a professor emeritus of Latin American Studies at USF in Tampa. He's a former Fulbright scholar. He's written, is it 24 books?
20.
20 books, and has traveled and lived extensively in Central and South America. Thanks to Frank Knox. He's been our phone producer today. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. And tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about hunting for Burmese pythons in the Everglades. How do you do it? We're going to answer that question. Stay tuned for NOLA. He's coming up next on the Midpoint program. I'm Rob Lurie. Thanks for listening. This is WMNF Tampa 88.5 FM. Let's go up to Washington, D.C. right now and get the latest news. And then right after that, stay tuned for NOLA and Midpoint here on Community Radio.